Tehran says it's trying to enhance cooperation with its neighbors, including with Persian Gulf countries, to establish lasting security in the region. Moscow saying its air defense systems have intercepted four U.S.-made missiles over a southern Russian region bordering Ukraine. And South African President Cyril Ramaphosa is re-elected leader of the African National Congress, paving the way for him to run for president in 2024. Hey everyone, welcome to World News. Here in the Iranian capital, I'm your host, Behzad Zajafi. Good to have you with us. Iran says it's trying to promote cooperation with its neighbors and Persian Gulf states to establish lasting security in the region. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says that Iran is ready to host foreign and defense ministers of regional countries to discuss security issues. He says Iran has repeatedly announced readiness to build trust and cooperate with its neighbors. The top diplomat added that regional states should abandon reliance on foreign powers for their security once and for all. Amir Abdullahian was addressing the third edition of the Tehran Dialogue Forum. This year's initiative is focused on Iran's policy toward its neighbors. It's attended by 70 officials and representatives from 36 countries. Israeli soldiers and settlers have been stepping up their attacks against Palestinian civilians in the occupied West Bank and other areas. Two Palestinian brothers have become the latest victims of Israeli settler crimes. A settler deliberately ran over them with his car in Nablus and fled the scene. Hamas's movement has accused the Tel Aviv regime of allowing the perpetrators to get away with such crimes to further incite violence against Palestinians.
An Israeli settler has run over two Palestinian brothers near the city of Nablus in the north of the occupied West Bank, making them the latest victims of Israeli settler crimes. According to Palestinian media, Mohammad Motair and his brother Mohannad had stopped their vehicle by the side of the road near the Zatara military checkpoint south of Nablus to fix a flat tire. It was then that an Israeli settler hit the siblings, who were traveling around with their family members at the time, and fled the scene. The victim's relatives said that 28-year-old Mohammed was killed immediately after being trampled on by the settler, while his brother, 24-year-old Mohannad, was seriously injured in the same accident and was later announced dead due to his injuries. Reacting to the atrocity, Hazem Qasem, a spokesman for the Gaza Strip-based Hamas Palestinian Resistance Movement, said the settlers are escalating their aggression against Palestinians. He added that the formation of the new right-wing government in Israel has apparently emboldened settlers to ratchet up their crimes against Palestinians. He described the incident as a new episode in the series of, quote, Zionist terrorism under the protection of the regime's police and army, saying this crime must be answered by increasing the resistance in the West Bank. Israeli occupation soldiers and settlers have been noticeably escalating their attacks against Palestinian civilians in the West Bank and other areas, in an attempt to forcibly expel Palestinians from their lands and make way for expanding Israeli settlements. Israeli forces have also been conducting overnight raids and killings in the northern occupied West Bank, mainly in the cities of Jenin and Nablus, where new groups of Palestinian resistance fighters have been formed. Since the start of 2022, Israeli troops have killed more than 210 Palestinians, including more than 50 children, in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds, as well as the besieged Gaza Strip. Earlier, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs described 2022 as the deadliest year for Palestinians since 2005, when the UN started to keep a tally of Palestinian fatalities. The world body says Israeli forces have shot dead 19 Palestinians, including 3 children, in different incidents across the occupied territories between November 22nd and December 11th. In addition to the killings, Israeli forces have blocked the main entrances of several villages across the West Bank, disrupting livelihoods of thousands of Palestinians.
And yet another provocative move against Palestinian worshippers, scores of Israeli settlers have stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Al-Quds city under pretext of celebrating the Jewish festival of Hanukkah. Now, Palestinian forces, factions, and commissions have called for defense of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Scores of Israeli settlers, guarded by police, have stormed the courtyards of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Al-Quds under the pretext of celebrating Hanukkah holiday. Earlier, the Israeli police stormed Al-Aqsa and forcibly expelled Palestinians stationed inside, paving the way for the illegal settlers to storm the compound. Israeli forces deployed heavily inside Al-Quds Old City in preparation for securing the settlers' incursions and preventing Palestinians from entering the mosque. Israeli settlers intend to storm Al-Aqsa for 8 days to celebrate the so-called Hanukkah, also known as Festival of Lights, which extends from December 18th to December 26th, as settler groups promoted the storming by announcing free transportation for its members. Israeli groups and extremist settlers had previously called for massive incursions into the holy site during the Hanukkah holidays. Hardline Israeli officials and settlers regularly stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied city, a provocative move that infuriates Palestinians. Settlers' incursions on Al-Aqsa Mosque frequently trigger clashes that leave casualties among Palestinians. Such acts of violence even led to an 11-day war between Palestinian resistance groups in the besieged Gaza Strip and the Israeli regime in 2021, during which the regime forces killed at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the latest raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli settlers. Hamas says such incursions are provocative and very dangerous. The movement has urged Palestinians to mobilize immediately in defense of Al-Aqsa Mosque. The resistance movement stressed the Palestinian nation will make sure to protect the mosque under any circumstances, warning Israel of the consequences of raids on the holy site. The Jewish visitation of Al-Aqsa is permitted, but as part of a decades-old agreement between Jordan, the custodian of Islamic and Christian sites in Al-Quds, and Israel in the wake of Israel's occupation of East Al-Quds in 1967, non-Muslim worship at the compound is prohibited.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky urging European leaders to supply his country with more arms as the war with Russia is grinding through its 10th month.
I ask you to support our country right now with a clear decision to provide everything that can not only maintain the dynamics on the battlefield in Ukraine, but also accelerate the movement of our defense forces to victory, because our victory will be the victory of each of you.
Zelensky urged Western leaders to convince their partners to supply Kyiv with modern weaponry, including armored vehicles and air defense systems, as soon as possible. He was virtually addressing a British led grouping of northern European countries, and that just hours after Kyiv reported a large scale Russian drone attack on its key infrastructure. A local official said on Monday that more than 20 drones were deployed in the strikes. Now, most of the UAVs were poorly brought down, but they incurred damage to critical facilities. Meantime, air raid sirens report in Kyiv and other regions after two Russian long-range strategic bombers took to the skies in western Russia to Ukraine's east. It's news review time. Stay tuned to Press TV. Now, Russia says its air defense systems have shot down four U.S.-made missiles and one of the first such claims in nearly 10 months of fighting with Ukraine. Russian Defense Ministry is saying its forces have shot HARM missiles over the Belgorod region. That's a southern Russian area that's regularly hit by Ukrainian strikes. The ministry also says that Russian forces have shot down 8 Ukrainian drones. They've also intercepted 6 rockets fired from the U.S.-made HIMARS and the Soviet-made Uragan multiple launch rocket systems. I could discuss this. I'm inviting a couple of guests. Our own Jana Minner, who is live for us now in Moscow and watching developments in Ukraine. Also with me is Greg Simons, who's a researcher with the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies in Uppsala, Sweden. So, Johnny, beginning with you, bring us an update on the latest regarding the war between Russia and the Ukraine, and also these U.S.-made weapons that Mr. Zelensky has been begging for all this time. Looks like many of them are just going down the drain.
Yeah, so at the moment, the frontline fighting is concentrated around Bakhmut. The Russians have been trying to take that city for a while. If they are able to take it, that opens up the rest of the Donbass region. It seems to be their primary objective. At the moment, that area has been called a meat grinder for Ukrainian troops, as Russia is overwhelming artillery superiority there. And as you say, Zelensky is calling for more and more weapons. At the moment, NATO is not giving Ukraine its most advanced weaponry. It's given the HIMARS system, a very effective missile system, but it's holding off giving other weapons. I recently spoke to a Russian politician, a more hardline politician here in Moscow, who said that Russia has far greater military capability that it's not using, and that they could destroy whole Ukrainian cities if they chose to. And one of the dangers is of NATO giving more technically advanced weapons to Ukraine. If Ukraine was to ever strike further into Russia, if it was to ever hit Moscow, for example, we could well see huge repercussions from the Russian side. So at the moment, this war is there is more stages of escalation that this conflict can reach, and it looks like it's going that way rather than in terms of peace talks at the moment.
Okay. Now, Greg Simon, speaking of U.S.-supplied weaponry, I mean, there are some Western media that are trying to fool the public, maybe especially in the U.S., that the U.S. does really care about the allies, including Ukraine. But some others are there, and analysts, and they're saying, they're arguing that this is only a proxy war that Ukraine is fighting for the U.S., for the West, spearheaded by the U.S., and they're getting victimized. And the main aim is to simply undermine and weaken Russia. How do you look at this?
Well, I mean, Americans have not been shy about calling what it is. It's a very, shall we say, advanced level of proxy war, because their investment in the proxy war is massive. But I mean, they've been saying from even before the war began, when you had the likes of Nuland, Victoria Nuland and so forth, saying that they'd have a war in Ukraine which would be used to weaken Russia militarily. And I mean, you've had the likes of speakers and representatives of the House and so forth. They've been saying things openly. They've been saying, for example, as so long as we keep supplying Ukraine with weapons, they'll fight to the last man. I mean, this is not concern for a so-called ally or whatever. I mean, this is purely pursuing their own selfish geostrategic imperatives at a time of the decline of American hegemony globally. I mean, as Kissinger said himself at some stage, America has no permanent allies or permanent enemies. It has only permanent interests.
Okay, appreciate the contribution. Johnny Miller in Moscow, Greg Simons in Uppsala, Sweden. Welcome back. Let's move on with the rest of this newscast. In South Africa, President Cyril Ramaphosa has secured his second five-year term as leader of the governing African National Congress. Ramaphosa beat former Health Minister Zweli Mkhize in a ballot at a party gathering in Johannesburg. He won some 57% of the ballots. Ramaphosa's re-election as the ANC leader sets the stage for him to contest the 2024 presidential vote. He was in hot water in recent weeks after independent special inquiry submitted a report suggesting he concealed the theft of several million dollars from his farm in 2020. Ramaphosa has acknowledged the robbery but denied any wrongdoing. The president challenged the report in court and was not charged with any crime, but some opponents still want him to resign. Now, thousands of Sudanese take to the streets of capital Khartoum to protest a recently signed deal between the country's military and civilian leaders. Protesters chanted slogans against the deal, calling on soldiers to go back to their barracks. They waved Sudanese flags and carried posters bearing images of those who have been killed during anti-coup demonstrations since October 2021. Security forces fired tear gas to disperse the crowd. The military and civilian leaders signed an initial deal aimed at ending the political crisis in the country on the 5th of December. Sudan has experienced political turmoil since last year's military takeover. The country has grappled with protests, an economic crisis, and rising ethnic clashes since then. More than 120 people are said to have been killed in the military crackdown on the protests. The UK says it will push ahead with its controversial plan to send migrants to Rwanda as soon as possible. A spokesman for the British Prime Minister made the announcement after London's High Court ruled that a deportation is lawful. The spokesman also said that the government was ready to defend against any further legal challenges to the policy. Rwanda has welcomed the ruling. According to a deal between London and Kigali, anyone arriving in the UK illegally since the 1st of January this year will be sent to Rwanda. The arrangement has met opposition from lawmakers in all the main political parties and even the United Nations. A series of legal challenges in British courts and at the European Court of Human Rights have stymied migrant deportation flights. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In the U.S., the Transportation Security Administration, TSA, has said it has recovered 6,301 firearms from airport security checkpoints so far this year, as of Friday, 16th of December, more than 88% of which were loaded. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. CBS News has covered this story. Transportation Security Administration officers have confiscated 6,301 firearms from airport passengers so far in 2022, the highest number recorded since the agency's inception. Of those guns taken at airport security checkpoints, 88% were loaded, the agency announced on Friday, 16th of December. The Transportation Security Administration, TSA, said it expects to have confiscated about 6,600 firearms by the end of this year, which would mark a 10.5% increase from the 5,972 firearms seized in 2021, which was also a record. The agency also reported on Friday that it was raising the maximum civil penalty for a firearms violation from $13,910 to $14,950. The top five airports for firearms stops so far this year according to the Transportation Security Administration, TSA, where the Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport, the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport, Houston's George Bush Intercontinental Airport, Nashville International Airport, and the Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport. Nashville had the highest rate of firearm confiscation per capita, according to a TSA spokesperson. In April, Representative Madison Cawthorn was cited for attempting to bring a gun through security at the Charlotte Douglas International Airport in North Carolina, according to local police. Madison Cawthorn admitted the firearm was his and cooperated with officers, according to police. He was issued a citation for possession of a dangerous weapon on city property. According to the Transportation Security Administration policy, individuals toting either loaded firearms or unloaded firearms with accessible ammunition can face fines starting at $3,000, plus a criminal referral to law enforcement. Those with aggravating circumstances, including a history of carrying loaded weapons into security checkpoints, could be forced to shell out the maximum fine. The Transportation Security Administration will grant civil penalty action only after completing an investigation. If passengers violate state laws, TSA refers cases to local authorities. The Transportation Security Administration also revokes its pre-check eligibility for at least 5 years for passengers caught with a firearm and routinely conducts enhanced screening for those passengers to ensure no other threats are present. ABC News has also covered the same story, giving us more details. The Transportation Security Administration, TSA, confiscated a record number of guns at checkpoints in 2022, most of which were loaded, as the agency has increased the maximum fine for firearm violations. The Transportation Security Administration, TSA, said it has recovered 6,301 firearms from airport security checkpoints so far this year, as of Friday, 16th of December, more than 88% of which were loaded. That surpasses the previous record of 5,972 firearms detected in 2021. TSA said it anticipates it will have intercepted some 6,600 firearms in carry-on bags by the end of 2022, which would be a nearly 10% increase over 2021's record level. The agency also announced on Friday, 16th of December, that it has increased the maximum fine for firearm violations to $14,950 to reduce the threat of firearms at checkpoints. Previously, the maximum fine was $13,910. I applaud the work of our transportation security officers who do an excellent job of preventing firearms from getting into the security area of airports and onboard aircraft, TSA Administrator David Pekoske said in a statement. Pekoske added, when a passenger brings a firearm to the checkpoint, this can consume significant security resources and poses a potential threat to transportation security, in addition to being very costly for the passenger. Firearms or ammunition are not allowed in carry-on bags at any TSA security checkpoint, even if a passenger has a concealed weapon permit. Transportation Security Administration regulations do allow passengers to transport unloaded firearms in checked baggage. Travelers must comply with state possession laws and are required to declare their firearms to airline personnel when checking in, among other requirements. Firearms detected in carry-on bags are turned over to local law enforcement authorities. Passengers who bring firearms to a checkpoint could face a fine, with repeat violations resulting in higher penalties. Offending travellers may also potentially face arrest by law enforcement officers depending on state or local laws. The firearms record comes as the Transportation Security Administration is seeing the volume of travellers rebounding to, if not surpassing, pre-COVID-19 pandemic levels. The website of Forbes magazine, Forbes.com, also has covered the same story. As of Friday, 16th of December, Transportation Security Administration officers across the country have intercepted a record 6,301 firearms at airport security checkpoints in 2022, according to the TSA. With just weeks left in December, the TSA expects a total tally of 6,600 firearms in carry-on bags by the end of the year. That will be about a 10% increase over 2021's previous record of 5,972 firearms and more than a 400% jump compared to a decade ago. Last year, a senior TSA official called out an epidemic of guns at our airports. But what is driving this epidemic? In 2021 and 2022, a wave of states including Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Indiana, Iowa, Montana, Ohio, Tennessee, Texas, and Utah passed laws no longer requiring residents to hold a permit to carry a concealed firearm. A legislative priority for the National Rifle Association, NRA, and other groups, permitless carry measures are now in place in half of all states. These new laws, combined with soaring travel demand in the third year of the COVID-19 pandemic, are contributing to an increase in guns at airports across the country, according to experts. We've got a significant rise in the population of new, never-before gun owners, and then we have a significant rise in new air travelers, a TSA official told Forbes magazine. Getting caught with a firearm at an airport checkpoint carries a civil fine of $1,500, according to TSA guidance, if the gun is loaded, as 88% of them are, according to the agency, then the fine jumps to $3,000. For repeat offenders, the TSA is bumping up the maximum potential penalty from $14,000 to $14,950. And that's not including lawyers' fees. Over the past 3 years, the Transportation Security Administration, TSA, has levied more than $52 million in civil penalties against travelers caught with guns at airports. As of October of this year, penalties had already topped $20 million for 2022. Firearm possession laws vary by state and local government, but firearms are never allowed in carry-on bags at any TSA security checkpoint, even if a passenger has a concealed weapon permit.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Sayyida Fatima al-Zahra salam alayha was somebody who manifested excellence in every dimension. First of all, when Fatima alayhi salam begins, the hadith says that she let As she, first of all, she went with perfect hijab, and she goes into this gathering of the Muhajirin and the Ansar, at which Abu Bakr is located. With that modesty and with that hijab, she begins to speak, and when she begins, somehow, some type of wail she lets out, that everyone who's there, they realize that something is drastically wrong, that the daughter of the Prophet has now come out and she has something to say. And everyone's attention is captured. And then she begins. And how does she begin? Alhamdulillahi ala ma an'am walahu shukru ala ma alham wa thana'u ala ma qaddam min umumi ni'amin ibtada'aha wa subughi ala'in asdaha and ila akhirih. And so on and so forth. This speech of hers was composed extemporaneously. She hadn't prepared it. But the great scholars, they say that if you want to know who Fatima alayhi salam was, if you want to know what her status was, you can go and study what the ahadith say about what the Prophet said about her. You can go and say what Imam Ali alayhi salam said about her. Or you can go and see what the Imams after said about her. You can also go and see the very words that she herself spoke, and then you can understand some glimpse of who Fatima was. Some little bit of the profundity and the depth of who Fatima was. Just see how she speaks about Allah, with what depth. Glory be to Allah for His great blessings. Gratitude to Him for that which He inspired. And praise be to Him for what He has brought to pass. And then she goes on to describe, what is it, a blessing of Allah? How can you measure it? What does it mean? What is our response that's due upon us when we consider all the blessings that Allah has showered upon us? There are at least 30 verses of the Quran that Fatima alayhi salam makes use of in this speech, which is known as the Sermon of Falak. And she weaves them in so skillfully into her speech, as if the Quran is just with her. It's part of her. It's one with her speech. And as part of this, she makes a point to comment on the political climate at that time. And this is the point I want to make, that here we have this lady who, yes, she was dedicated to her worship and her devotion and supporting her father and supporting her family and taking care of her kids. But she was somebody who was deeply aware of her responsibility when it came to the political environment, of supporting the imam of the time. And you can tell from her speech that she was not at all ignorant or simple when it came to her being able to perceive the deeper workings of what was happening. She was seeing through the plans of these people and their plots very clearly. And that's why we see in her speech that she says that when Allah chose, and I'm just taking the translation, when Allah chose to take His Prophet, the thorny tree of hypocrisy appeared amongst you, and the robe of a religion became ragged. You were wearing something, you were showing that you belonged to the people of religion, but now that robe is started to fade away. Your true colors started to show. The misguided who were previously silent began to speak. What is she talking about here? She's saying she understands exactly the events that were taking place while the body of the Prophet was left unburied. The unknown few arose and the liars came forward, braying like camels as they strutted, wagging their tails to your courtyard. Satan, Shaitan, raised his head from his hiding place and called out to you. He found you responsive to his call and attentive to his deception. Brothers and sisters, the great scholars, they tell us that these words of hers that were spoken, not only were they an eye-opener to the people who were present at that time, because when she spoke, obviously the word came out that the daughter of the Prophet is saying these things. What is she trying to convey to us? But not only was it something that was a powerful message at that time, but for centuries to come, this became a sanad. This became something that the Shias would refer to and say that, okay, you say what you're saying, but what was the position of the daughter of the prophet, of the household of the prophet. What was her position? What was her take on the events? And throughout history, it's been that document which is a proof that this is what the Ahlul Bayt, and this is the dhulm that was done to him, to them. But brothers and sisters, there's one line that I just want to say, and then inshallah move on, where when she's saying to Abu Bakr regarding her claim to the land of Fadak, she says this line, وَزَعَمْتُمْ أَنْ لَا حَظَّ لِي وَلَا إِرْثَ مِنْ أَبِي. You claim that there's nothing that I'm inherited by, I can't inherit anything. Right? Is it the case, she asks, أَفَخَصَّكُمُ اللَّهُ بِآيَةٍ أَخْرَجَ أَبِي مِنْهَا. Is it the case that a verse has been revealed to you that somehow my father was excluded from? Right? Are you getting a Quran that my father's not getting? Or is it that you say, Inna ahla millatain la yatawarathan? This is something where one of our great scholars, Ayatollah Jawadi, he says that there's a line in this sermon which is more heartbreaking than whatever physical wounds may have been done to Fatima alayhi salam. Right? And it's this line that he points to. He says that Fatima has to ask them that, is it the case that you think that وَلَسْتُ أَنَا وَأَبِي مِنْ أَهْلِ مِلَّةٍ وَهَذَا. Is it the case that somehow you imagine that me and my father are not from the same religion? Meaning what? That are you somehow indicating that I'm not a Muslim, that I should not be able to inherit from her father just like any Muslim has the right to inherit from? Imagine that Fatima alayhi salam has to stand in front of a crowd of people and ask them that somehow, do you doubt my Islam? And this is none other than Sayyidatun Nisa al-Alameen. Right? This is the sanad, this is the document that we have of proof that has been there from throughout history. And then she goes on to say, you know, that أَمْ أَنْتُمْ بِخُصُوصِ الْقُرْآنِ وَأُمُومِهِ أَعْلَمُ بِمَنْ جَاءَ بِهِ. Is it the case that somehow you now have more knowledge about the verses of the Quran and how to interpret them than the people that it came to? This is the position that you are assuming for yourselves? This is an example for us, brothers and sisters. An example of how is it that a Muslim, a Muslimah, a mu'mina, how is it that when it comes to performing their duties, it's something which is a comprehensive, holistic approach? Fatima alayhi salam, when he was called for, you find her supporting her father. You find her nursing the wounded on the battlefield. You find her bringing food to her father at the trench, at the Battle of the Trench. But when the duty calls for it, you find Fatima alayhi salam with all the modesty, but having that courage to speak up for the truth, having that courage to make sure that her imam is not left without any support. Inshallah, we can use this example of Fatima alayhi salam as inspiration for ourselves.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Moscow charged Kiev's Western backers with ignoring its warnings that NATO's informal expansion into Ukraine was crossing Russia's red line. Officials in Moscow said Ukraine is being used for a proxy war against Russia by the United States and its allies, and they want to destroy Russia with illegal sanctions. But Russia will confront them and is trying to increase its economic interactions with countries of East Asia and the subcontinent, such as China and India, to deal with the economic sanctions. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Sputnik News Agency has covered the story. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko said on Friday, 16th of December, imposing new sanctions on Moscow is a choice of the European Union, but these measures undermine the interests of the member states of the European Union as well. The Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko said, European Union states are abandoning market principles in energy, finance, and in many other areas. This is their choice. But this choice, when implemented in concrete actions, undermines international economic relations in the form in which they have been formed in recent years and undermines the economic interests of these countries. The Russian diplomat said it is impossible not to see that all these sanctions benefit the United States, adding that Russia will develop measures to ensure its economic interests. On Thursday, 15th of December, the European Union agreed in principle on the ninth package of sanctions against Russia. The final technical procedure for the execution of these sanctions package completed on Friday, 16th of December, after which the sanctions must be published in the EU official journal. After that, they will come into force. After Moscow launched its special operation in Ukraine last February, the US, the European Union, and Britain imposed economic restrictions against Russia. In October of this year, the EU adopted its eighth package of sanctions against Moscow, which included a legislative basis for setting a price cap for maritime shipments of Russian oil to third countries. In December, the European Union also joined the G7 decision to set a price cap on Russian oil at $60 per barrel. The cap will be reviewed every 2 months to remain at 5% below the International Energy Agency benchmark. However, Moscow refused to accept the price limit, saying that Russian oil would only be sold to countries on a market basis. So far, the sanctions have resulted in a major fuel crisis in Europe, record high inflation, and skyrocketing energy prices. The English website of our Sharq al-Awsat newspaper has also covered the same story.
Russia says the European Union's latest round of sanctions against Moscow will just exacerbate economic woes within the European bloc. The latest measures, which blacklist nearly 200 more people and bar investment in Russia's mining industry, are part of the ninth wave of sanctions imposed on Russia since President Vladimir Putin ordered the launch of a special operation in Ukraine on 24th of February this year. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova reacted to the measures on Saturday, 17th of December. Zakharova said the current package will have the same effect as all the previous ones, exacerbation of socio-economic problems in the European Union itself. Maria Zakharova also called on the European Union to cancel all restrictions that are having a direct or indirect impact on Russian exports of grains and fertilizers. Russian President Vladimir Putin said recently Kremlin would expand trade cooperation with new partners, including by sharply ramping up gas exports to China. Back in November, the Chinese President Xi Jinping reassured he is willing to build a closer partnership with Russia in the energy sector. Citing an Indian oil ministry source, the Reuters news agency reported recently that New Delhi will continue buying Russian oil and even look for term contracts as sanctions allow purchases, provided that Western services are not used. China and India are currently the largest buyers of Russian crude oil. German newspaper Bild am Sonntag has also covered the same story. The German newspaper Bild am Sonntag reports on Saturday, 17th of December, that dozens of Russians and Belarusians have filed lawsuits at the EU Court of Justice to challenge their inclusion on the sanctions list. The Luxembourg-based court has reportedly received claims that from one company and 61 individuals from Russia and Belarus placed on the EU blacklist over their alleged support for Moscow's special operation in Ukraine. The business figures are seeking to challenge what they view as a violation of their rights and the freeze of their assets by European Union authorities. According to media reports, the plaintiffs in Luxembourg include Russian billionaire and former owner of the English football club Chelsea, Roman Abramovich, ESN Group owner Grigory Berezkin, and Gennady Timchenko, who owns Volga Group, a Russia-based company with interests in the energy sector, transportation and construction. Alpha Group co-founder Mikhail Friedman and Alisher Usmanov, the owner of Russia's largest iron ore producer, are also among those who are suing. The European Union has adopted 9 rounds of anti-Russia sanctions since last February, when Moscow launched its special operation in Ukraine. Aside from business people, the penalties include measures against Russian journalists and Russian companies. On Friday, 16th of December, the European Union blacklisted 141 Russian individuals and 49 legal entities, including ministers, governors, judges, parliament members, singers and presenters, as well as 5 political parties. The latest measures also deprived 4 more Russian media outlets of their broadcasting licenses in the European Union, introduced a number of export bans, and extended restrictions on 3 more Russian banks. Export restrictions were extended to 168 additional Russian entities closely linked to the Russian military-industrial complex, bringing the total number of sanctioned companies to 410. Meanwhile, European leaders approved an 18 billion euro macro financial assistance package for Ukraine for 2023 to ensure that Kiev can cover state deficits and keep the economy running as it continues to fight Russia. To fund the aid and loan it to Kiev at a highly concessional rate, the European Union will raise common debt, a proposal that initially met resistance from Hungary. but Budapest lifted its veto recently after EU nations agreed to allow the sum of the EU funds it has frozen under the new law of law mechanism from 7.5 billion euros to 6.3 billion euros. A Polish veto over the introduction of a minimum global corporate tax also threatened the adoption of the assistance package on Thursday, 15th of December. But Warsaw, a staunch supporter of Ukraine, also lifted its objection. Russia launched its special operation in Ukraine last February following Kiev's failure to implement the terms of the Minsk agreement and Moscow's recognition of the breakaway regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. At the time, Russian President Vladimir Putin said one of the goals of his special operation was to denazify Ukraine. Since the outbreak of war, the United States and its European allies have imposed an array of sanctions on Russia while supplying the large cache of advanced weaponry to Ukraine, despite warnings from Moscow.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Role of arrogant powers policies in recent bitter events in Iran is obvious. This is the part of speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. This ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Officer and Police Training. If you look at Europe, especially France, massive riots occur every now and then on the streets of Paris. I want to ask you, has the US president or the U.S. House of Representatives ever supported European rioters? Have they ever issued a statement saying we stand with you? Is there any record of the mass media, which is affiliated with American capitalism, the U.S. government, and their mercenaries, like some of the governments in the region, unfortunately, such as the Saudi government? Is there any record of them supporting the writers? Is there any record of them announcing that they will provide this hardware or that software for the internet and put it at the disposal of writers so that they can easily communicate with each other and carry out their plans? Is there a history of such a thing happening anywhere in the world, in any country? But it happened here, and not just once or twice. It has happened many times, over and over again. Well, how can you not see foreign hands at play? How can an attentive person not sense that there are other hands behind the scenes of these events? Other policies are at play.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, they falsely pretend that they care that someone has passed away in the world. They are lying. They are not upset by this at all. In fact, they are happy. They're happy because they have a pretext for creating unrest. They lie. Here, the heads of the three powers of the state, executive, legislative, judicial, expressed their sorrow and sympathized with the grieving family. Then certain elements murder other people who are innocent and have not committed any crime. The judiciary promised to follow up on this to the end. This is what investigations are all about. It means following up on a case, saying the results, and saying if anyone was guilty of something or not. And if someone was guilty, identify them.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.